Hi, I'm Ted Price from Insomniac Games, host of the AIAS Game Maker's Notebook. On this episode, we're joined by Jeff Kaplan from Blizzard. Jeff is the game director for Overwatch, which is played by millions of people around the world. But Jeff was also instrumental on World of Warcraft, a game that shaped many of our lives, certainly mine. And today, we get to talk about Overwatch, about World of Warcraft, about Jeff's early play in EverQuest, and his thoughts on culture and feedback from gamers. So if you're interested in Overwatch, game design, or the industry in general, check it out. Jeff has a lot of great things to contribute, and I know you'll learn a lot.
Welcome to the Game Maker's Notebook, a podcast featuring a series of in-depth one-on-one conversations between game makers providing a thoughtful, intimate perspective on the business and craft of interactive entertainment. The Game Maker's Notebook is presented by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, a member-driven organization dedicated to the recognition and advancement of interactive entertainment.
So it's my pleasure to welcome Jeff Kaplan, Game Director on Overwatch. And I know that many, many, many people listening right now have played the games that you have created and are currently playing one of the biggest games in the industry right now that you are heading up. So welcome. And I just wanted to also point out that we are here at Insomniac in Burbank, which is right down the street from your Overwatch arena.
Yeah, well, thanks for welcoming me, Ted. It's awesome to be here. I love Burbank too, not only because of Blizzard Arena's here, which is where they play Overwatch League, but I grew up in La Cañada, which is right down the freeway.
It's a beautiful place.
Yeah, between Pasadena and Glendale. So I always feel like I'm coming back home when I come to this area. So it feels great.
So are you over here frequently to go to the arena and see how things are going with the league?
I go to the arena, I would say, every few weeks.
Okay.
It's not very far. It's about 60 miles from Irvine, which is where Blizzard is located. But it can take anywhere from an hour and a half to like 3.5 hours. So that part is a little bit insane as far as traffic goes. I love going to watch the matches. I always wish that either Blizzard was up by the arena or the arena was down by Blizzard, one or the other, because I think I would go to every single game.
Did you guys choose the arena because of its proximity to other studios, or just Burbank made sense for your fans?
I think Burbank made a lot of sense for the arena for a lot of different reasons. Orange County doesn't have quite the TV video production capabilities that LA does.
Yeah.
So that's a really obvious reason. And the other thing that was really cool was just the opportunity of that old Tonight Show theater, you know, where Jay Leno and Johnny Carson, you know, had their shows. Is really cool when you're backstage in the Blizzard Arena. There's still this big mural of Ed McMahon and Doc Severinsen and Johnny. And for me, like, I'm old enough where I remember the Tonight Show, and it's like this great feeling of nostalgia. And then to think that there's these amazing young esports players who probably have no idea who these guys are, is just like a hilarious irony to me.
That makes sense. One of the coolest things, though, for me about what you guys have built are the walls. I mean, just I've been able to discern is that they are they giant LED walls that you can change into pretty much anything?
They're LED. There are so many panels, it's overwhelming. Like when people we give a lot of people tours of the arena who are coming by to visit, and there was one group in recently that came in and thought it was all painted because we had one of the maps up, and they're like, "Oh, it's painted beautifully," and we're like, "That's not paint. Like, that can change." And then they changed the walls for them, and they're like, "Wow, that's really amazing." We had a really fun time designing the theater and designing the stage, because the thought was that what we're trying to do, hoping to do, is make esports more approachable to mm-hmm. people who don't normally watch esports. And we felt like a lot of that was adding a level of polish and approachability that previously hadn't been there. And then there's also a certain Overwatch aesthetic, which is, you know, bright, colorful, big saturation, simple, flat images to try to get that same vibe in the esports arena was really important to us. So we had some really great people who worked on it. I had nothing to do with it, so I can take no credit, but I was really impressed with all the time and effort that went into that.
Got it. Well, we're going to talk a lot about Overwatch League a little bit later, but I want to go back a few years, probably many years for you, and ask about EverQuest. And I want to ask about that because I was an EverQuest fan too, and my wife would have to just rip me physically away from playing. And what was it like for you when you were playing?
I loved EverQuest. EverQuest was a life-changing moment for me. So I started playing, I think, in 1999, which I believe is a year that it came out. And between 1999 and 2002, I had over 272 played days of EverQuest, because you could do that slash played command and it would show you how long you played. For better or for worse, I wasn't married back then. I think it's probably a good thing. I don't know if the marriage would have survived how much EverQuest I played, but it was life-changing for me and for many, many reasons. But from a video game perspective, to have a game which created a world in which other people lived and existed with me was something that I had never had before. You know, there was never a game that really worked at that scope. There were some online games back then, and then there were great world story games that were mostly single player, but to have thousands of people interacting and all the politics and drama that sort of surrounded that was just eye-opening. Like, it was, I wish, it's one of those things where, and this is a ridiculous statement to say, but I wish everybody had that chance to have that EverQuest experience in their life from a video game perspective, because I think it was just life-changing.
Well, that also led to Blizzard for you, right?
Yes. So for better or for worse, whenever you're playing obsessive amounts of video games and you have friends who don't play obsessive amount of video games, they're always asking, like, "What? Why are you doing this? You're throwing your life away. Nothing's ever going to become of this." And the irony of playing so much EverQuest, and this is pure coincidence, is that I found out many years into it that many of my guild mates were actually Blizzard employees. And I didn't know it at the time, but my guild leader was Rob Pardo, who was the lead designer on Warcraft 3 and was actually designing Warcraft 3 at that moment. And he had invited Alan Adham into the guild, who was one of the original three founders of Blizzard. And like, it was awesome. We played so much EQ together that at one point they invited me down to Irvine to visit Blizzard. And it was a little bit embarrassing because I didn't know what Blizzard was. I was more of a shooter fan, so I was obsessed with the guys at id, and I really looked up and I knew all the developers' names there, but I didn't really know what Blizzard was. I actually had to look it up. And I went down to Irvine. We had this amazing lunch, because it was the first time I was ever able to talk openly about video games and not be sort of ashamed. Yeah. I know it sounds ridiculous in 2018 to say that, but like, back in 2001, 2002, there was sort of a stigma attached with playing games. And we had this lunch where we're talking about dragons and, you know, how are we going to defeat different dungeons? And I was just so happy. And what I didn't realize, and I know now through hindsight, is they were really having me down there to sort of test the waters, because they knew that they were working on World of Warcraft. I didn't know it at the time, but they were working on World of Warcraft. And eventually I remember Rob saying to me one night in guild chat, check the Blizzard job page tomorrow. I'm like, okay, I'll check. And sure enough, the next day there was posted a position for an associate quest designer. And it was hilarious because they required a creative writing degree, which is what my degree is in. And it's the most useless degree you can ever get at an institution, is a creative writing degree. And I'm like, this is like all very premeditated. And that's sort of the long version of, you know, how I stumbled my way into the games industry.
Well, I mean, going on to design quests for arguably the biggest MMO in the world is a pretty great next step. I mean,
yeah, it worked out. Yeah. The funny part is, if you rewind to 2002, which is when I joined Blizzard, we were in mortal fear of failure on that project. Very few people had worked on an MMO. There was about 40 people when I joined the World of Warcraft team, and everybody thought EverQuest 2 and Star Wars Galaxies were going to rule the universe. And we were all, I mean, we were huge MMO fans, and we were looking forward to those games. So you had this feeling of, like, we're stepping into the arena with giants, and who are we? And we would get asked all the time when the game was announced and press would come. It was really funny because they would always say to us, you know, who are you as the RTS company to think that you can make an MMO and go up against these other great games like EverQuest and EverQuest 2 and Star Wars Galaxies? And we were always very, like, sheepish about it. Like, yeah, we love those games. We can't wait for them to come out. And we had no idea, you know, if our game was going to succeed or fail. It was really only Alan, who was the lead designer on World of Warcraft at the time. Alan was the only real believer that the game was going to be huge. And I remember he stood up one time in front of the team and said, "This." We were all just licking our wounds after E3 and seeing Star Wars and just how awesome the game looked. And then Alan, like, kind of gave the team a big morale speech, and he said, "This game's going to have 1 million subscribers someday." And we just were like, "He's crazy." You know, call the ambulance and put on the straitjacket. Because EverQuest was setting records with 400,000 subscribers, which we thought, I remember John Smedley logged in and said through, like, he had some all server chat command. John Smedley was the head of Sony at the time. And when EverQuest had broken its concurrency record of 400,000, Smed came on and announced to the whole service, like, "We just broke 400,000. And it was like this, I felt like this special moment, like I was there in the building when it happened. So to hear Alan say we were going to have 1 million subscribers was just like crazy talk.
But you eventually did. And I had to ask you just a more micro question, because I'm fascinated by quests in open world games and MMOs and how you actually approach that. So when you were designing quests, did you create a set of rules eventually just as you designed more and more?
We did. We eventually, and the process continues to be refined today. When we set out, there were two quest designers on World of Warcraft originally, myself and a brilliant guy named Pat Nagel. And we started off with Alan just brainstorming, like, what are the kind of quests we think would be fun in this game? And we came up with a bunch of different templates. And then we spent a lot of time with engineering because there were concerns about some of the quest ideas and how they would work in an online persistent game with so many players. And then it really was a matter of trial and error.
Okay.
So early on, I remember sitting with Alan and trying to predict how many quests the game would need. And we were sort of using, you know, EverQuest and Asheron's Call and DAOC. We were looking at other big world games and just making a gut call of how many quests we thought we would need. And we started working on our first prototype zones, which were Elwynn and Westfall. And being very naive, Pat and I just split them up. Like, okay, Pat, you take Elwynn, I'll take Westfall. We'll each take a shot. We'll put an alpha up and see how the company does. And we came from this very EverQuest mindset, which was you'll have a few quests that will kind of take you to an area. And then once you're in that area, you'll be excited that there are creatures to fight, and then you'll fight the creatures for a few hours and eventually get bored and then go look for a new quest after that. And we were so wrong. We put the alpha up, and, you know, Elwynn probably had like 12 quests at the time or something like that. And Pat and I shared an office, and immediately people were angry in our office, like our coworkers on the team. They're like, "Something's broken. You guys didn't hook this up right." And we're like, why is it broken? Well, I went and I did the quest, you know, with Princess over at the farm, you know, the pig that I had to kill, and I did it and I got the ring, and then there was no quest after that. And we're like, "Well, you know, did you see the gnolls? You should have just gone and like fought the gnolls." They're like, "I'm not doing that. That's so boring. Like, that's why I don't play these games. Like, I need more quests." And I remember as soon as that alpha ended, Pat, Alan, and I were just kind of sitting there going, "Oh no, what did we sign up for?" Because we realized at that moment, like, that was sort of defining in WoW's questing history of there's a new paradigm here, and what previous games have done is not going to be acceptable if we want this to be broad and far reaching. But today, the quest team on WoW is amazing. They're so much more sophisticated than we ever were. They literally flow They have very intense flow charts with guidelines. We always try to have guidelines instead of rules. Mm-hmm. As soon as you call something a rule, as creative people, we all want to break it. That's our first instinct. Like, ooh, there's a rule. I'm going to break that rule. So we always say, here's some guidelines for you to work within. But now it's like very intense, and they flow out every zone quest by quest, and they have a really good idea of how many quests should be in an area, how much time players should be spending on a quest. We were more Wild West back in those days.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, for better or for worse, like the players were our laboratory rats that we were kind of experimenting on. Like, do they like this? Oh God, they hated that. Never do that again.
What is your... What drives you nuts about quests today that you see in games? What are some of the things that you like to avoid?
Oh, well, there's some immediate obvious stuff that feels broken to me in quests today. I don't like it. World of Warcraft, the older quests, the ones that Pat and I made, so we're the guilty parties of this. The new people don't do this anymore, thankfully. But back in the day, we used to rely on the text chat at the bottom of the screen, like where the social text was happening. So you'd click on a quest giver. You know, they'd say like, hey, go get the book and come back to me. And you go do the adventure and you bring the book back to them. And rather than just completing the quest, because we had a story we wanted to tell, the quest giver would like go through some pantomime. You know, they'd walk around the wizard sanctum or whatever. And we'd just be printing these text lines to the chat, which was our like brilliant story that the world needed to hear. But as a player, like fast forwarding to how MMO players play, it's like you bring the book back, you want to turn it in, and then you're off, you know, you're not standing around paying attention. So there's all these quests that feel really broken that we had made way back in the day because we were very naive about how players were going to play. That drives me crazy. I used to make a bunch of quests that sent you all over the world. We thought there's a certain amount of breadcrumbing that's good in quests because you're trying to introduce players to areas that you think they should go. But sometimes we would just egregiously, you know, hey, I need one thing from the Hinterlands, one thing from Blackrock Spire, and one thing from Stranglethorn Vale, which, you know, it would take you like 40 minutes just to travel to all those places, let alone get the thing. So that always drives me crazy in a quest. And then also... it drives me crazy when a quest doesn't take into account social play. Hmm. So a lot of times as quest designers, it's very easy for us because, you know, we're tuning and testing on our own. It's the weirdest thing that you're basically running your own private World of Warcraft server when you're testing the game. And you always do everything by yourself. But the game inherently is built to be this great cooperative social experience. And there's a lot of quest mechanics that don't take that into account and only work for one person. And that's one of those things that the World of Warcraft team is very savvy about now, and they don't make the mistakes we were making back in 2002. But we had these moments where it's like, oh, I need you to ride the Griffin, and you'd click on it and you'd be in a group of like five, and then the one person would just like zip off into the air, and then everybody else is standing there and they're like, could you turn in your quest? I'm like, nah, it's broken. I can't turn it in. And then we get a lot of bug reports.
That makes total sense. So are there any companies that Blizzard looks to today as, or you look to today as examples of people who craft really great quests outside of Blizzard?
Yeah, I'll give you a really odd example. And people are always shocked when I say this, but I think Rockstar is one of the companies that's most amazing at doing open world content and open world questing. GTA 5 is nothing short of a masterpiece. And what's odd is it makes me sad in some ways. I have so many friends who won't give GTA 5 the time it deserves because the shocking nature of the content and the very mature nature of the content. And they'll always say to me, like, I can't play an anti-hero, and it's not like I need to be a paladin when I'm playing. I want to feel heroic, and that game doesn't make me feel heroic. But one, I think the story and the writing is brilliant in the GTA games, but the way that they craft the open world content and have a main storyline and side adventures from a pure game design standpoint is masterfully done. And the fact that they have to coordinate so many people, I mean, I don't know how you build a GTA 5. Like, if you were to send us back to Blizzard and say, we just want to straight copy GTA 5, you've seen the game, you've played the game, we just want to purely replicate it, I wouldn't even know where to start, how you direct people to have such a cohesive vision in such a massive game. I think that's a great example.
I would agree. I mean, and they disguise it well, because I think when you go into the game, it's not what you're expecting. You're expecting this gritty story about bad guys, but it's well disguised. You are constantly given non-repetitive quests, and it kept my interest for sure. But I actually am one of those people who had trouble being the anti-hero in the game, which kind of leads me to talk a little bit about your culture at Blizzard. And I think you've, in your DICE talk a couple years ago, or actually last year, you talked a little bit about the culture of heroes. And I think it was one of your colleagues, Chris Metzger, saying Blizzard's a hero factory. So do you at Blizzard deliberately steer away from dark themes?
We do. It's not that we steer away from dark themes. So like Diablo is a mature rated universe that we have with very dark themes. But what Chris means when he says we're the hero factory is not that we're a company that cranks out heroes.
Right.
It feels that way on Overwatch sometimes, you know, we're always working on new heroes and launching them all the time. But what he means by it more than anything is that what a Blizzard game should do to the player is make them walk away from the computer or the console or phone, tablet, whatever they're playing on, and feel like a hero.
Mm-hmm.
Chris defined the company culture using the D&D alignments. He said, we're lawful good. That's the company we are. And even though we love games like GTA, or we can make a game like Diablo, which skews a little dark at moments, we always have to come away from it from that sort of lawful good standpoint. And we're trying to make our players lawful good.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the goal.
That totally comes through, I think, in everything that you guys put out. I mean, and I'd say even Diablo, because I know when I play, I do feel like a positive force in this very dark world. Maybe not dark. It's actually stylized dark.
Yeah.
But it's a cool
dark
cool
for Blizzard.
Yeah. Exactly. In terms of the culture, how do you actually describe the culture to new folks who are joining?
Blizzard is really interesting today in 2018 because we're much larger than when we started. When I joined in 2002, it was only 200 people. Today, at last count, we were somewhere around 4,800 people. There is a core culture to the company that I think is defined the minute you step onto campus. There's an orc statue, and it's huge. It's like 12 feet tall, with the most menacing looking heroic orc you've ever seen, with the company values right around it. So that, I think, immediately sets the tone, which to me is always larger than life, colorful, diverse in the fact that, you know, if you look at World of Warcraft, it's not just eight different versions of humans and elves, that it's, you know, there's orc and tauren and trolls and all sorts of crazy, like, celebrating diversity in our worlds, in our universe, or even like the core of StarCraft, the fact that it's these three races that couldn't be more different from each other. Those are the things at the company level. And then there's also this really great vibe, we call it One Blizzard across the studio, of just really caring and respecting for the fact that once a company hits a size that's big, we recognize that not everybody does the same job.
Yeah.
But we all share some of the same values. And everybody there cares about games and cares about our players first and foremost. Where you really start to see unique cultures is on the teams themselves. For example, the building that I'm in, we share a floor. We're on the second floor, and we share the floor. It's half the Hearthstone team, half the Overwatch team, and below us is the Diablo team. So we're both above the Diablo team. And the three team cultures couldn't be more different, even though we're all at Blizzard. Team 5, which is the Hearthstone team, for example, they feel like they're a family. They feel like they're all brothers and sisters. And I always think it's adorable. Like, you go out, first of all, they work different hours than everybody else does. They get to the studio earlier than everybody else, and they leave earlier. Like, they just decided as a team, we're going to work these different hours. So they're always eating meals together at these different times, and it's got that real family vibe. The Diablo team are like masters of their craft, is the best way I could describe them. They've been making Diablo for so many years, and they love that that universe so much that it's like second nature to them. They're very master craftsmen. The Overwatch team, I think, is very different in the sense that we try to take great pride in our community, mm-hmm. and take great pride in what the game stands for outwardly. And we try to embrace those values as much on the team as possible. And the number one value that's there is inclusivity. And then shortly followed after that is this sense of empowerment. So the way we run our team is we feel like we have the best possible developers we could have to be making Overwatch. They're there because they love Overwatch. Therefore, they shouldn't be micromanaged. They should be given all the power that they have to do great things, because we know they're going to make it great, and don't sort of micromanage them. And I think that feeling of empowerment then makes its way into the game itself, because that's what the heroes are ultimately trying to do for the players, is go, hey, you are an awesome individual. You belong here. Let's make you feel super powerful, no matter what your background was or your level of experience.
Well, that diversity, I guess, in that empowerment of people of diverse races, genders, et cetera, is very apparent in the game. And I remember you said at one point you were criticized for the diversity in Overwatch. And I was surprised by that statement. And I kind of wanted to ask why.
It's been a long time since we've gotten a criticism about diversity. I think anytime you're creating a game that takes place on Earth that is anywhere remotely near our time period, there's this immediate magnifying glass that gets applied to you of, are you treating humanity like it deserves to be treated? And I'm glad that that exists. I'm glad that we're under that scrutiny. I'm glad as creators, we're held up to a very high standard, because it makes us think about it a lot. It makes us be very thoughtful when we're approaching, you know, hey, we're about to do something in somebody else's culture. Let's make sure that this is a version where they would be super excited. Like, let's try to do the version where they're going to reach out to us and say, wow, I'm so glad that you included me in your game, instead of the version where they're reaching out and saying, oh my God, this is an embarrassment to who I am. So it's very nerve-wracking. What we tried to do with Overwatch is not approach diversity from any sort of way that would feel pandering. And the example I always give is, we didn't set out to make the game and have a spreadsheet of every group on the planet we thought needed to be represented, and we're just trying to put like check marks next to them. We really did want to tell a story about a group of individuals who were people. We didn't want to generalize anybody or try to roll up any sort of, you know, race, religion, nationality, affiliation. You know, we didn't want to roll that up into one and say all people are like this from that group. We wanted these to be like actual people. So yeah. Like, you know, Tracer's Lena Oxton, who was a RAF test pilot. And we know that her girlfriend's name is Emily, and she lives in London, and she's a very real person. But that doesn't mean everybody in the UK is like Tracer.
Right.
In fact, our UK office hates the phrase "Cheers, love." They're always teasing me. They're like, "Oh, it sounds so." We don't say that. It sounds ridiculous. I'm like, the rest of the world loves it, though. But that was very important to us, and I try to point out to people, like, if our goal was just to represent as many different people as possible because we felt an obligation to do it, we wouldn't have ended up with like two Japanese brothers. That it takes too long to make a hero. You know, why spend two of our chips on the two Japanese brothers or the Egyptian mother and daughter?
Which I think is one of the coolest stories you have in the game. I mean, that the fact that you have somebody who is that age as a playable character and with that backstory is unique.
It's awesome. I think for us, you know, I'm 45 now, and I think, you know, when you're in your 20s and your 30s, you think of like anybody who's heroic has got to be in their 20s or 30s, yeah. And everybody else is ancient. And now that, you know, I'm a little bit further along that trajectory, I start to have a lot of sensibility towards, you know, there are a lot of badass people at all ages, at all walks of life. We always remember the moment when we were watching Fury Road, the latest Mad Max movie, which was so amazing. And they had those women at the end, the women snipers, and we're like, wow, they're really, really awesome. And so it made it easy for us to have characters like Soldier 76 and Anna Amari, and just these, you know, there's nothing wrong with being older, and that doesn't mean you have to become like this sub side character. Like,
sure.
You could just be an awesome badass and we could celebrate that.
Who's the oldest character, or what's the age of the oldest character?
I think it's Gabrielle Reyes, who is Reaper, but it's kind of not a fair answer because technically Reaper is dead. But I think that's a little bit questionable. So Gabrielle Reyes was like Jack Morrison's partner. They were Soldier 76, and he was in Overwatch, and then he kind of goes bad and there's a horrific thing that happens and he becomes Reaper. But technically Reaper would be the oldest.
And how old is Reaper?
Oh, Michael Chu's gonna kill me. It's between mid 70s and early 80s.
See, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kudos to you guys for continuing to sort of push the boundaries. And I think that really is a great example for the industry. But going back to this idea of getting critique and kudos from fans, you guys must get an insane amount of feedback. I mean, when we were talking earlier, prior to turning on the mics, we were talking about Reddit being a place where you get lots of feedback. And so I am interested, and I think most developers are interested in how you filter that, how you pull out the nuggets of actionable items from the probably overwhelmingly good and sometimes bad comments you get.
I think all of us as developers treat feedback differently. And all of us, I think, have a different capacity for processing feedback. For me, where the ability to process feedback really became a thing in my life was back when I was a writing student. We would do these creative writing workshops where you had to write a short story. Then the class was going to talk about it for an hour. And it was about 12 people in the class. And the only rule was you're not allowed to talk. You just have to listen to the critical feedback. So I think that gave me a very high tolerance for being criticized. And it gave me the ability to realize that not all criticism was a personal attack. Mm-hmm. And if you try to interpret criticism as people wanting the thing that we all love to be better, it can get you in a healthy place. Now, I think a lot of people don't know how to communicate feedback really well. So what I've tried to do is I try to process their feedback in a way that's more productive. So like, for example, here's something that I'll hear on our forums or on Reddit. They'll be like, Hanzo is garbage. He's F tier. You know, that's a statement that I'll read 20 times in a day. And instead of just going like getting angry or defensive about it, I try to think like, well, what are some of the issues the person has with Hanzo? And do we need to improve Hanzo or not? And should we be looking at him? I always try to use things like the forum, Twitter, Reddit, anywhere where we're getting tons of critical feedback. I almost try to use it like a barometer where you're just... really using it as a gauge to see where's the community at right now, and is something bubbling up to the point where even though my own personal opinion is that it might be fine, it's bubbling to a point where it's obvious in the community that it's not fine. The other thing that the community tends to do is they tend to come to us with solutions. You probably experience this all the time on your games. You know, just make the main character jump higher.
Right.
You know, that like they'll come to you with that. And the way I always try to relate to people is, you know, imagine going to your doctor and just like barging in the office, like slamming the door open and going, I need a shot of penicillin right now. Like, The doctor's going to ask some questions first, because if he's a professional, like what he does for a living is diagnose and treat ailments. And I feel the same way as game developers, where we try to be professional. We try to master our craft and know what we're doing and be in touch with our game. So rather than have somebody sort of shouting a solution at me, I always prefer when people can just tell me how they feel mm-hmm. about something. I don't know what it is about competitive play, but when I play, I feel really frustrated. Every time I lose, it feels really terrible, especially when I'm watching the end of round screen and I see my skill rating drop. Like, that's so much more informative to me than somebody saying, like, just do Dota 2's competitive system. Because I want to know why. I want to understand at a deeper level. So that's some of the ways that I try to process feedback.
Well, so that is I think it's really useful for everybody to hear. And just as an aside, because we're both using the word feedback a lot, I know that's a word here at Insomniac that is just repeated ad nauseum, and in a good way. But are there kind of words that you think that have been embraced by the Overwatch team that have become sort of your own language, just specific words that you guys use and maybe the other teams don't?
Oh, geez, I'm trying to think of a good example. I have World of Warcraft ones, like, okay, right off the bat. I'm trying to think of a good Overwatch one. I'm stumped on that. So in World of Warcraft, we had a ton of different names. Not so much for, some of it was for feedback, but like just mechanics in the game got named things. Like we would, anytime you had a boss mob and...
Well, mob's a good one too. I mean,
oh, I think mob, yeah, I guess.
Mob made, was that originated by you guys? Was that something that?
No, that was. I think that came from the MUD community.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. We used MOBI,
okay,
which was monster object, and I think we added a Y to it. But that may have come from somewhere else too.
I think Warcraft 3. This was before my time. I joined right when Warcraft 3 was shipping, but I think Warcraft 3 coined the phrase creeps.
Okay.
And creeping. So, okay, yeah. I'm going to go out and creep, and which is like a terrible, disturbing thing to say, you know? But we all know what that means. But that's one. But we had this thing we called mograining, which was if there was a boss in a dungeon and you aggroed the boss, aggro is another great one,
yep,
you know? Engaged the boss before it was in combat. I'm just realizing how much lexicon I use. But if you engage the boss before it was in combat, aka aggro, the whole dungeon would come running at it. And we do this because sometimes you want to create nonlinear spaces, but you still want people to like do the whole dungeon and not just beeline to the boss. Well, the first time we had ever done that mechanic was in the Scarlet Monastery with one of the bosses whose name was Mograine. So then it just became Mograine after that. There was a type of quest in WoW that was called a pumpkin quest, which was any quest where you went out, like if they sent you to a library and you had to like bring back 5 books that had been scattered across the floor or something, that was called a pumpkin quest. And where that came from is the first quest of its type was in Tears Fall Glades, where you had to go and loot 5 pumpkins.
I think I remember that.
Yeah. And then you brought the pumpkins back and they like poisoned a guy.
Yep.
But that was a quest that I made. And that was the first time we were able to do that mechanic. Like it seems ridiculous now. Every MMO that's come out since 2004 has used that exact paradigm. But at the time we were so excited. I'm sure you guys have this all the time as developers, where we're like, oh my God, we came up with this new mechanic and we got the tech to work and it's great and we're learning how to tune in. It's like, now it's just called the pumpkin quest.
That's good. Well, one other one that's external springs to mind. That's Leroy Jenkins.
Yeah.
I remember when that became a thing. How did you guys react to that?
We loved it. Well, the weirdest part about Leroy was that was on the cutting edge of YouTube. Hmm. So like YouTube wasn't yet huge when World of Warcraft first shipped. And definitely the predecessor games to World of Warcraft, like EverQuest, like sharing video content, like we just couldn't stream fast enough. It was very uncommon to have video clips and stream video content. And I remember that Leroy was one of the first videos where it really went viral. And it was particularly hilarious because I think all the World of Warcraft players at the time could just relate to that moment. You know, you were so dependent on other people. Here was this like heavily online cooperative moment where content was tuned really difficult and so much time was invested. And I think we all had that moment. We all had a Leroy in our group who just sort of didn't know any better or got a little antsy and had to run and just ruin the whole night for everyone. But that, like, we've embraced that. There's a Hearthstone card called Leroy. Like, and I hear Leroy now, it's like a common term that's used.
Yeah. It's in our culture.
Yeah. Super bizarre. It's super awesome.
That's great. Well, thank you for taking that small journey away from Overwatch for a second.
Course.
It's good memories for me. But getting back to Overwatch, again, given the amount of feedback you get and the size of the game and your gamer population, when you guys make tweaks, what's the process for vetting those and then getting them out and watching the reaction?
We always start internally with a discussion. We have a very small design team on Overwatch, and that's something that I very, very much value. We have 8 designers right now, and I think when we launched, we had 7 designers, which if you go and look through the Blizzard, the various Blizzard games, all the credits, it's the smallest design team on any project. The reason that I like that the design group is so small is we all sit in the same room. And so we're able to discuss every change and proposed change that we want to do. And we discuss all the feedback regularly. So we're looking at places like Reddit, our forums, Twitter, YouTube, every single day. We're listening to what people say. And then we'll just have open discussions in the room. Hey, what do you think about this? Do we agree with this? Do we not agree with that? Let's look at the statistics. So it starts with a discussion. And then what we'll do is we have a large number of playtests that happen on the Overwatch team every day. We have regular playtests that happen every morning at 9:30 and at 6 p.m. And then any developer on the Overwatch team can just shoot off an email and say, hey, I just put a playtest up. I need 11 other people to help check out this thing. And so throughout the day, that's happening.
And that's with Blizzard team members who are just jumping in, or is that going outside of Blizzard?
It's just the Overwatch team.
Just the Overwatch team.
Yeah,
okay.
At this point, it's literally just the Overwatch team. And we'll try all sorts of radical things. So like Jeff Goodman's our lead hero designer, and we'll have a hero that we'll be looking into. Like, for example, we are making changes to Hanzo right now. And early on, our players were upset with him, and we felt like he wasn't in a good place. But before we went public with anything, Jeff went a few weeks, if not months, of just trying crazy things. Like, you know, what if Hanzo's arrows could pierce through shields? And what if they pierce through other enemy players? So if, you know, they're all lined up in a 6 stack, it just went through all of them and did damage. And what if scatter arrow worked differently? What if I remove scatter arrow? He would just try all sorts of different things. And it's a very safe environment because the Overwatch team is not critical of him. And we don't have this like knee-jerk reactionary feedback like, oh my God, they're destroying Hanzo. How dare you do that? We know we have a lot of faith and trust in Jeff that he can just try things out. Once we start to feel good about it, we will usually either socialize it on our forums. Mm-hmm. So I might go on the forums and make a post. You know, someone will say like, Hanzo's in deep trouble in Overwatch and he needs help. And I might very deliberately make a post like, oh yeah, we're looking into changing him right now. And I'm specifically doing it to get a reaction out of people. Like, let's see if there's a lot of positive sentiment around this, a lot of negative sentiment. And sometimes I'll even float the ideas that we're trying. Oh, Jeff just tried this the other day. And then it's immediate, you know, you just sit there and you hit refresh on the page to get reactions. I especially like the ones that come right away, the gut reaction. Mm-hmm. Because over time, you get more of that echo chamber, refined, we the community have decided this is good or bad, and anybody who disagrees with that has been beaten to the fringe, you know, as it is. Then we'll do a period on what we call the PTR, which is our public test region, and then we'll usually iterate there as well. It's very easy for us to update it, and then we'll put it live. And even after things are live with Overwatch, with hero tweaking, we still have to go back. We know, like, for example, Hanzo's on the public test region right now with his changes. His changes will go live very soon. I think they go live next week.
Okay.
And then once they go live, we know we'll probably have to touch him a few more times to get it just perfect. Players on the public test region don't play the same as they do on live servers. There's just a totally different type of player behavior that happens. And so we're not always getting the perfect level of feedback from the public test region. We're just doing our best to get gut reactions. The other thing that's been really helpful is we have the Overwatch League now. And we have over 100 pro players in the Overwatch League, and we have a Discord channel with them. And we can float things into, they have different channels in there, and one of them is just feedback, where they're sometimes they're just giving feedback to, you know, what it's like to be an Overwatch League pro. Like, I don't like how the headphones work or whatever. But we can also go in there and say, you know, hey, this is a change we just did to Hanzo on the public test region. If any of you guys are free, can you go and check it out and let us know what you think? So we can get that very high level feedback. Or sometimes the best case scenario is sometimes the pros will do a scrim,
yeah,
where they'll get 12 people together on the public test region, and they'll play for an hour. And oftentimes they'll let us watch. They'll even let us know, hey, we're scrimming tonight at 6:00 if you want to watch the Hanzo changes and see it at a very high professional level. So it's nice that we have the full range of, you know, our average players, we can judge what they're doing all the way up to what it'll look like at the pro level.
I think that's going to be really good information for any Overwatch player who's listening, because I'm sure there are a lot of people who are constantly wondering what's the magic that goes into these just knob turns that can make a huge difference in the game. So that's really great to hear. But since you brought up Overwatch League, I have a bunch of questions about that. And you've taken a huge step into the esports arena with Overwatch League. And I think that when we here at Insomniac talk about esports, we generally agree that there can only be one or maybe a couple 800-pound gorillas in esports, because it's so all-consuming. And so what's your opinion? Can there be more than a couple 800-pound gorillas?
I think so. I mean, if we look at pro sports, there's certainly more than one 800-pound gorilla. Like, I'm a huge NHL fan, but we have NBA fans on our team, NFL fans, MLB fans. So I think there's European soccer, you know, there's football. I'm sorry. I just call it European soccer, which is like an absolute taboo. Rest of the world football. So I think there is definitely room for more than one esport to be great.
Well, that's really useful for me to use that sports analogy, because usually when I talk about esports or we talk about how they're designed, we're not making that direct connection to professional sports. And yeah, you're right. That is, and you guys have made a deliberate attempt to model the Overwatch League over professional sport with professional sports in mind. And that's, I think that's been a breath of fresh air. And certainly it seems like it's helping expose what we're doing as an industry to a much, much greater audience.
I think that was the single most exciting thing to us when we were forming the league. We had the commissioner of the league is a great guy named Nate Nanzer. And he had this just amazing vision. And he's a huge sports fan, pro sports fan. Actually, European football is his favorite. But he loves baseball, and I love hockey. And we were actually at this breakfast in Germany. We were at Gamescom. And he and I just went on this huge rant together about esports, because we felt like there were these like two completely divided communities. One was the pro sports community and one was the esports community. And people got so touchy and bristly. If you ever talked about like, hey, I like pro sports and esports, they're great. It felt like this almost divide between the two. And the way that Nate and I used to always talk about it was, there's so many amazing things that esports does and is doing that pro sports can never do. You know, we can have unlimited cameras on the field that are invisible and clip through players. Like, think of all the amazing things that esports can do, or that literally anybody has access. Doesn't matter your physical stature. Like, that's a really exciting thing. But also, there's all these just tried and true, amazing things that pro sports have been doing, and not only doing, but doing for over 100 years and doing so well. And it feels like up until this point, esports almost like deliberately was turning a blind eye to it and saying, you know, no, we're esports, we're different, you know, we're not going to do all that crazy stuff. Like, why would you ever have region-based teams, you know? And we loved, I think both Nate and I had such a love for both arenas that we felt like there is a world where these two things can combine, and you really could borrow from the best from both worlds, and try to get more people on board. The regional thing, everybody in esports told us was going to fail. Hmm. They said, you know, that's the dumbest thing ever. You know, just saying a team is from London doesn't mean the team's from London, and why would anybody cheer for it? And immediately after we announced the teams, we had people like, okay, I need the London jersey. I grew up in London. I'm so excited for the Spitfire, and I can't wait to, you know, I can't wait to watch every game. And there was an allegiance that brought people into it. I know, like, I have that. As I grew up in Los Angeles, so if I go to a sport that I'm not normally watching, of course I'm going to root for the LA team. You know, you want that. You want sort of that easy onboarding. So I think there were a lot of little things like that that just were important to us. The other thing that I think was super important was protecting the players, mm-hmm. and celebrating the players more. So the players have guaranteed benefits, guaranteed minimum salary, guaranteed share of the prize pools. I think there was a lot of exploitation happening of players in esports, and we felt like it, like our ultimate goal is, you know, I would love it in 5 years from now if when people talk about Overwatch, they don't know who any of us are, like, as game developers. Like, that's just boring and uninteresting to them. But, you know, man, there's these superstar players and they have posters of them and they're wearing their jerseys. Like, the players are who should be the stars of Overwatch. Yeah. And that's what we're really trying to build.
Well, speaking of protecting players, I mean, there's definitely been talk of unionization of Overwatch players, teams. What do you think of that?
I think it feels like an inevitability that the players can and will unionize. That's not really up to us. A lot of times people come up to us and say, like, well, why aren't you forming the players union? And the first answer we always give back to them is like, well, we're not the players. Like, it's sort of the players union needs to belong to them. But certainly if there was a players union, you know, Blizzard and Overwatch League would work very closely with it and be very supportive. And in a lot of ways, it opens some doors for us once there is a players union of things that we can do with the league that are exciting.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. Well, speaking of players, what advice would you have for an avid Overwatch player who wants to eventually become a salaried player?
There's a really great path for Overwatch players that we've built in. So first, if somebody was like an amazing Overwatch player and wondering how to become pro, the first thing that they can do is play a lot of competitive mode and get into the highest ranks of competitive mode, which for us is Grandmaster. They then become eligible for something called Open Division, where they can either form a team or we put them on a team if they hit a certain minimum skill rating. And then they can start competing in what's equivalent of our amateur leagues. And then one step up from the Open Division is a division that we have called Contenders. And Contenders is regional semi-professional teams in areas like Korea, North America, Europe. I believe we have a Contenders in Australia and Latin America as well. So then they can compete in Contenders. And then oftentimes, either entire Contenders teams have been bought by Overwatch League teams to become the team, or individual players get pulled up. And a lot of our Overwatch League teams also own a Contenders team, and we'll use it as a farm team. Sometimes for different reasons, they'll either they're developing players, or we have some players who aren't of age yet to participate in Overwatch League who are playing Contenders until they turn 18. So it's actually, there's a very clear path. The other advice that I would give players who want to make it in Overwatch League is be very good online citizens, because the more famous you become as a player And if you're somebody who streams or takes part in online tournaments, the more eyes that are on you. And we found that when some players want to go professional, if they have skeletons in their closet because of how they behaved online, those skeletons will certainly come out. And they've led to some interesting stories for our Overwatch League players.
I'll bet. That's great advice for anybody playing online. I mean, it doesn't matter what game you're playing.
I learned that myself the hard way. Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah. I was a very vocal EverQuest player, and I was just very, very naive. I was not a game developer when I was playing EverQuest, and I think I used to rant about things that were very unfair. I didn't know how to communicate. You know how earlier we were talking about players don't really understand how to give feedback or how to communicate, and not only did I not know how to give proper feedback on a game, I also didn't understand game development. I think it's very easy for us as game developers to sort of process what it would actually take to do some of the things our players ask. But our players, when they ask them, they're just asking from an emotional place where they feel like, wow, the game would be cooler if it had this. And it's not their job to worry about technology or tools or, you know, is the game even architected to do the things they want to do? So I was one of those, you know, loudmouth, ignorant players. But hopefully I've matured out of it by the age of 45.
And you could design quests, right?
Yeah,
so that
exactly.
was also, that was another.
I think nice I've been trait. Going, I've been at Blizzard for 16 years now, and I call it like 16 years of karma of just, I'm every time I open Reddit or the forums, there's a little bit of payback for each day that I was a vocal player. And I have to take it with as much grace as possible because, you know, I opened that door on myself.
Yep. Makes sense. So when you guys announced the league and you announced the $1 million prize, I got to tell you, my jaw hit the floor on that one. And I'm sure that happened throughout the industry. And it's an amazing and a very amazingly positive thing, I think, for us as an industry. What effect do you think that will have on our culture here in America?
Well, I hope it has a couple of different effects. Like one, obviously bringing awareness. I think the more people who become aware of esports will also become aware of gaming. There's still a lot of people. I love the generational shift that we're going through right now. The younger generation right now grew up with video games as a form of entertainment, a form of art. It's in pop culture, it's mass media, it's accepted, it's normal. I feel like in our generation, it depends who you are, how accepted games are and how recognized games are for their impact on society. I'm very excited for games to be even more in the limelight, and hopefully things like the prize pool will bring people's attention to the fact that this is a big deal, and this is a real thing, and these aren't kids playing with a toy. These are professional athletes competing at the highest level of a sport, which is really cool. The other thing that I hope that it does is just attract better players. You know, the more there is to win, the more recognition, the more money, the more fame, the more people will want to compete to be the best. And I think it will attract highly competitive, super skilled players. And the more of those players we attract, the more exciting the sport is to watch.
Yeah.
So I think there's a certain snowball effect there that's sort of inevitable.
With that in mind, is there anything that has happened in the league so far that you didn't predict or really surprised you?
I think one of the things that I found absolutely heartwarming about the league, like I pictured when I would go to the Blizzard Arena and watch Overwatch League, that it'd be this very like hardcore young adult male sports crowd. It was kind of what I was expecting. And it's absolutely heartwarming when I go to the Blizzard Arena and it's, you know, men and women of all ages. There's so many parents with their kids. And there's two dynamics with the parents and the kids. One is the kid who absolutely loves Overwatch and begged either mom or dad to bring them to see an Overwatch League game. And then either mom or dad gets super excited and they actually get into it, which is cool. And they have this like shared moment. And then the other dynamic I've seen is the mom or dad who loves Overwatch and loves video games and wants their kid to grow up with the experience as well. And so bringing the kid to see, like, look how cool this is awesome. And, you know, I remember when my dad brought me to my first baseball game, and what a magical memory that is for me. And to think that Overwatch League is providing that experience to people, you know, that we could be the first baseball game for a lot of these families is very special to me.
Agreed. So I just want to ask a couple more questions just about you personally.
Okay.
And what it's like to be you. And I read a quote from an article in Rolling Stone where the writer said that gamers everywhere secretly dream of a life like yours. Do you think that's true?
I think it's probably true. I feel so incredibly lucky. You must feel this way too. I never knew that I could be successful in the video games industry. I never thought I could be successful in life, to be honest. But to enjoy success in such an amazing industry where it's so creative, so many people are super passionate. It's all about fun. It's about entertainment. It's about shared experiences. I feel like I'm the luckiest person in the world. Every day I go to work, and I'm largely surrounded. Like, I wish the entire Overwatch team could be here on the couch with me right now, because I'm not saying this to be humble. I'm saying this because I believe it. They're all so much more talented than me. Like, I'm just sort of the dopey spokesperson, you know, at this point, who gets to be surrounded by these amazingly talented and creative people. And then our fans are the same way. Like, they're just so much fun. And they just, they add so much to the experience. Like, it's not about making the game. It's about making the game for people to enjoy it together. And I'm there online every single night with them anonymously. They don't know that I'm there enjoying all the same things they're enjoying, not enjoying the same things they're not enjoying. And I just feel really lucky to be a part of it.
I think that's a great statement. I think all developers who are working in our industry, one time or another, will feel that. I mean, we are, and it's easy to forget. I think we get so myopic about our work that you lose perspective sometimes in terms of what we're doing and the joy that we bring to others. And that it really is gratifying about being in this business. And I would say there are probably very few businesses or industries that provide that kind of opportunity.
My wife once, she's really good at humbling me. So this is during the time that I was working on World of Warcraft, and I was super stressed out, and I was, you know, totally overwhelmed. And I forget what I was even working on at the time. And I came home and, you know, I'm kind of grousing to my wife. I'm like, Angela, I'm so upset. Things are so stressful. I don't know how we're going to get through this time. And I'm just grousing to her. And she turns to me and she says, really, how stressful is your day? What is the hardest decision you had to make? What type of hat to put on the orc today? Like, come on, you make video games. And she just, like, put me in my place in that moment. I realized, like, yeah, she's right. Like, and like I said to you earlier, as stressful as it can be, it's only stressful because we care and love what we do.
Yeah.
And there's so many people that I know who are just doing their job because they have to do a job, not because they care about it. And if the price that we pay is some stress because we care and we love what we do, I'll take that any day over not caring.
100% agree. So last question for you, and I'd like to ask this of people who are in your position who have been in the industry for a long time, and that is, do you have any advice for gamers or designers who want to follow in your footsteps?
Yeah, absolutely. It's something I love talking about. First of all, I think it's important for people to be less focused on, I want to be a designer or artist or programmer, and focus more on, I want to do design, which I think there's a fundamental difference there. Anybody can do design, whether you have a title in it or not. And there's such a big spectrum of video game development that you could do, especially in this day and age, with so many engines available for free. You can go and get Hammer for Source. You can use Unity, Unreal, pick up the StarCraft II editor. There's so many things that you can do. Like, I have this dream someday I'm going to make a game in PowerPoint. That's going to be my engine is PowerPoint, because I'm just sick of PowerPoint. I'm like, how do we make it fun? I've seen games made in Excel before. So I think if you have the desire to make games, you know, get cardboard and cut it up and make a board game. There's nothing stopping you from making games now. And if you're not the type, there's so many different jobs in games that there are other things you can do. Like, one of the things that I did to get into the industry, besides like picking up editors, there was an editor called WorldCraft that was the Half-Life one editor that I was making maps in. I was writing a blog before the word blog even existed. You know, I would just write about EverQuest and write all my design thoughts every night. And I had an audience who would read the blog, and they would read my thoughts about just putting design thoughts together. We had one person who applied for a design job at Blizzard who had never worked in the games industry before and was actually the head of a math department of a high school, but really loved World of Warcraft. And he put the entire Druid class into Excel and had a spreadsheet that was like the working version of the World of Warcraft Druid inside and out, every statistic, every bit of math behind it, that just showed his design aptitude and talent. That guy's now actually the lead systems designer on Hearthstone, named wow. Chris Zierhut. But like, anybody can get into games if you have a passion, and nothing's stopping you from making games now. So just do it. We would love to have more people making games.
That is fantastic advice. So how can people reach you if they have questions or feedback on Overwatch?
So I read every single Overwatch Reddit thread that exists, which is a fun and time-consuming process. I read our forums all the time and often respond there. We also have a Twitter handle of @PlayOverwatch, which we watch all the time. That's another great way to get in touch with us. I'm trying to think what other avenues there are. I think that's about
it. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. The fact that you're on Reddit all the time and reading comments is unique.
Yeah, we have. There's also another Reddit called /r/competitive Overwatch,
okay.
Which is another one that I read every thread every day. So, you know, we're always there. We're always paying attention.
Very cool. Well, hey Jeff, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you, Ted. This was quite an honor.
Thank you for joining us for the Game Maker's Notebook. For more information on the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, our podcasts, and our other initiatives, please visit www.interactive.org.